You all had a good Shabbos. We'll start our plan now of dividing up the pure halacha l'maisa section from the lumda section, so to speak. That once a week we'll try to focus on some of the practical halacha issues that come out of the sugyas that we're doing during the week. So since we've been learning Zareya, we still have a little bit left to do, so we'll focus on some practical issues in Hilcha Zriya. I'm not sure if we'll cover all of them today. We'll try to focus more on the ones that are relevant to things that we've seen already, and we'll see how much we cover. But first, we should definitely acknowledge today being September 11th and the 10th anniversary of the atrocities that took place here in New York City and in Washington. It shouldn't go without mention, particularly as we read yesterday morning of the obligation to remember the attack of Amalek, Zechiras Maisa Amalek, and its striking consideration. There's a discussion, the halacha, that maybe there's a difference between the way we read it yesterday and the way we read it a year ago. That there are some poskim who raise the question of, it's not really clear from the Torah. The Torah tells us there's an obligation to remember Amalek, and that pretty much everyone acknowledges as a mitzvah of some form. It's pretty clear from the Gemara it's a mitzvah of some form. We mentioned on Thursday that the question of the mitzvah to remember Miriam is somewhat of a dispute how much that's an actual mitzvah. But remembering Amalek, that's generally agreed upon as a mitzvah, even though the question of whether the Kriyas HaTorah that we have before Purim is actually, all of that is actually necessary, that's a longer discussion. We'll talk about that Purim time. But some form of Zechiras Amalek is clearly a mitzvah. So we have a practice to do it the Shabbos before Purim, even though it's not clear in the Torah what the time period is. Do we have to remember Amalek every day? Do we have to remember Amalek once a month, once a lifetime? It's not clear where you get this idea that it should be done once a year, that it should be done before Purim. So there are those who suggest that it's based on an approach that was advanced by the Chasam Sofer. It's quoted in the Talmidim of the Chasam Sofer, that there is an idea of a sheer shikha, that since the Torah says not to forget, so there is a certain period of time after which one starts to forget. And he has various rayas from the Gemara. He could argue on the rayas, the Sat Merav for the Tshuva in which he argues on the rayas, but that it sounds like from various places in Shas that 12 months is the period of time. After 12 months, you start to forget things. So since the Torah says don't forget, so that means don't let 12 months pass. So based on that, there was a concern that some had and others did not have, but Maram Shik, who was a prominent Talmud of the Chasam Sofer, raised this concern that when you have a leap year, as we did this past year, so then you're going to have 13 months in between the two fulfillments of the mitzvah of Zechiras Amalek. That the extra month is placed there right before other Sheni, so you end up having a 13-month interval. So some thought that that was a concern, and that in those years, we should have in mind, when reading Parshas Ki Tzeitzei, that we should have in mind to fulfill the mitzvah of Zechiras Amalek through that Kriyas HaTorah. So it means not yesterday, but last year, when we were anticipating this 13-month interval, we should have intent to fulfill a mitzvah d'oraisa. Well, yesterday's Parshas Ki Tzeitzei, that was already a normal Kriyas HaTorah d'Rabbanan. So there were those who were concerned about that. And there were those who didn't think that was an issue. There were those who didn't think that this was something to worry about. Even if we assume that we should remember Amalek once a year, we don't have to worry that a leap year is going to mess up the cheshbon. And it seems that what you have here is two different conceptions of what the issue is. That we talk about forgetting, and we assume, if we even acknowledge the premise of the Chasam Sofer, that 12 months is this idea of a sheer shikha, that you're going to forget after 12 months. So what do we mean? Do we mean 12 months passing, that after a certain amount of time elapses, so then you just start to get fuzzy on things and you need a reminder? Or does it have to do with the cycle of the year? You have anniversaries, you have events, that the same thing you were doing last year this time, what were you doing? On Hanukkah comes to Hanukkah, so last year it was lighting Hanukkah candles, and I'm lighting Hanukkah candles. So every time the year goes around again, things kind of reset, and you need to have a reminder when you're doing the same things you were doing last year. of what you had to be thinking about last year. So it's perhaps two different conceptions of what this obligation of Zechira means and what this obligation not to forget means, just not to allow too much time to elapse, or to recognize that when we're doing the same thing we were doing last year, we have to try to characterize that moment with memory as well, otherwise we're going to forget. And this is probably related to the machlokis that exists also about a yard site during a leap year, that if somebody passed away during Adar in a normal year, in a Shana Pshuta, and then comes a leap year like this past year, so there's a whole discussion which Adar should count for the yard site, and you have essentially three views. Either the first Adar is the real one for the yard site purpose, or the second Adar, or there is a view that's also quoted that we should hold both Adars, which is a strange idea. If the idea is we should remember the person once a year, so once a year should be enough. What's the idea of 2 days? And it seems to also reflect perhaps this question, is it that we don't want to let a year pass without taking note? Or that the day has a significance to it, and let's say the fifth of Adar has a significance, and if that year there's 2/5 of Adar, so maybe both of those days have significance. So these are really two separate conceptions of what it means not to forget and to remember, whether it means, in the case of the yard site, not to forget those who are no longer with us, or whether it means, in the case of Zechiras HaMalek, not to forget a tremendous act of evil and essentially terrorism. And of course, we talk about this anniversary, albeit on the secular calendar, but it's clearly a noteworthy date. So we have both elements. We have the element of remembering, as God says in Parshas Beshalach, that His throne is not complete as long as there is such a force in the world, and that we have a combination. But on the one hand, we're obligated to remember and fight Amalek, and HaKadosh Baruch Hu says ultimately it's his war, ultimately he's going to be the one to fight Amalek. And presumably he fights Amalek to the degree that we work to not be that way, that we work to be a force for good in this world. And therefore, particularly on occasions like this, it's incumbent upon us to pause and to focus and to both not allow too much time to pass without thinking about it, and also to infuse the moment with a consciousness and an awareness so that we are a force for good, and that we remember those who were taken on that day, many of them who chose to endanger themselves to save others, who chose to stay behind to be with others. And that's a tremendous inspiration which we're obligated to try to keep alive as well. The yeshiva is learning Yavamis, even though, again, we're learning Shabbos, we try to take note of the Yavamis connections. So there's also a theme in this past week's Parsha, the mitzvah of Yibum. And the Torah uses the word shame to uphold the name of the Nifter, somebody who was taken away too soon without having a chance to leave inheritors, without having a chance to leave people who would carry on his name. So the Torah says the mitzvah to remember, to uphold his name, to do this action, to uphold his shame. But the Gemara says that really it's not about shame. The Gemara has a question whether it's an idea if a child is born to literally give him the name of the Nifter. And the Gemara says it's not really about that. It's really about the Nachla. It's really about his inheritance. It's about his legacy. And that's a theme here as well, that all of these individuals who were taken too young and everything that they had to contribute to the world as a message and as a legacy. So part of our obligation of Zechira is to try to carry on all of these positive messages so that we create a world where the forces of Amalek are greatly diminished, if not actively, at least by contrast and at least by balance. And I think that's an important theme to keep in mind on this occasion. With that, so we return to the task of Talmud Torah. So to talk a little bit about some of the concepts of Zriya. So as we mentioned today, we'd like to focus a little bit more on the halachic concepts rather than the lumdish concepts. But what about one of the main lumdish sections does have a halachic implication? So we spent a lot of time talking about the central lumdish sugya of the Minchas Chinuch and the Rashash, of the whole question of when one violates the Isser of Zriya. Is that prohibition violated at the moment that you put the seeds in the ground? Or do we assume that it's only violated later when there is an actual taking root. There's an actual hashrasha. And as we mentioned, so among the practical differences would be the question if one could cancel this aveira in the middle, if one were to come after Shabbos or at any point in between the 3 days and take the seeds out of the ground, so would one cancel this aveira and essentially save himself from whatever chiyuvim are relevant? So that has many lumdish implications, as we spent some time on Wednesday and Tuesday. But what about the practicality of the matter? So what should one do if one does find that he has unfortunately planted some seeds on Shabbos? So does this machlokas impact on what steps he should take? So it seems that the majority of poskim who came after this whole discussion probably favored the view of the Menaches Chinuch that essentially the Isser is violated when one puts the seeds into the ground. And therefore, it's not really possible to undo the Aveira afterwards. However, there are some other considerations. That first of all, since there is another view, and it's not really clear that we can absolutely pass in one way or another, this whole machlokas is less than 150 years old, so it's not necessarily clear that we have an absolute tachra. So being that the view of the Rashash is that it's still possible to undo it, so perhaps we should be encouraged to take the seeds out of the ground for that reason, so that maybe we can maintain the possibility that we're not going to violate this Isser, which that was the view of the Shvisas HaShabbos, for example, who did maintain that you should take the seeds out of the ground. The question becomes, so should you do this on Shabbos? Should you do this immediately? Or are there any Shabbos issues involved? So one question is it an issue of muktzah? And if it was an issue of muktzah, so it's interesting, again, from a lumdish perspective, so muktzah is an Isser Drabanan. So you might get into the whole sugya on Shabbos and Daf Dalet, are we allowing you to violate Nisr Drabanan in order to save yourself from a Nisr Daraisa? But here it's not, we're not confident that the parallel is really there to a full sense, because it seems everyone agrees, based on the Gemara, that if you take the food out of the oven in the middle, you will stop the Aveir from happening. Here we're more kind of just taking into account another opinion, since we do have the Menaches Chinuch's view, which seems to be the majority view, that you can't really save yourself from the Aveira. So since we're just kind of after the fact trying to take into account the minority view, so we have less to even come into the conversation that would justify the Isser Muktzah. So the question is there an Isser Muktzah or not? So it depends what kind of seeds we're talking about. If we're talking about edible seeds that are food, so then it shouldn't be muktzah, and then it should be mutter, presumably, to take them out. If we're talking about the kind of seeds that are not used as food, they're just purely seeds. So then there is, in general, it's basically the distinction between what seeds are going to be muktzah or not. So then there is a muktzah issue, and presumably you shouldn't take it out on Shabbos, although the truth is, doesn't seem to be much reason not to do it on Sunday, because on Sunday you're still within the 3-day window, and presumably that should be just as good. Gil, is that what you wanted to ask about?
I want to ask about the Shvita Shabbat. Mm-hmm. So he says to do like the Rosh Hashanah just a chumrah, but really like Menaches Chinuch.
It seems to be his position, yeah, that basically the Menaches Chinuch is probably right, but that since the Rosh Hashanah's view is out there, so it's probably worth trying to stop it anyway, just in case there is the possibility of stopping the Aveira, you might as well do it, unless there's some other Isser involved. So if there's an Isser Muktzah, so then we wouldn't let you do it. But if the seeds aren't Muktzah, so then presumably you should be able to take them out. You see, the assumption here seems to be, and we touched upon this a little bit also, we'll get into this more, that we're not assuming that Zoreya and Kotzer are direct opposites. That even though they are general opposites, the Zoreya basically being about putting something into a source of nourishment and growth, and Kotzer basically being of cutting it off, but we're not necessarily assuming a direct halachic parallel. That in other words, any time you violate Zoreya, to counteract that is an Isser Ketzira. So that seems to be the assumption that most take, and there are various rayas that that's probably true. So it doesn't seem to be that we're afraid that even if we assume, like the Menaches Chinuch, that you violated Nisr Zriya, that taking it out would necessarily put you in a position of kotzer, just that it would put you in a position of possibly dealing with muktzah. There are some who suggest, it's possible Shlomo Zalman Auerbach is quoted in the Sefer Shulchan Shlomo, that maybe there is a reason to be machmir on that, that maybe not because we assume that they are directly inverse, but maybe in the other sense, that maybe the Ketzira has a reason to be more machmer, that maybe even before there is a hashrasha, that there is a nourishing going on, and that maybe that starts immediately, and that maybe to take it away from this source of nourishment is some form of kotzer. So that's a later suggestion. I don't think the earlier svarim seem to have been worried about that. Again, if you do it on Sunday, it's not clear what the downside is. On Sunday, it would seem to be that you're not in violation of any Isurim, and if we're assuming that you're not, if we're assuming that we're wondering about the possibility that maybe you can cancel the Zareya, it should still be possible to cancel the Zareya even after Shabbos. I guess just the concern is you don't want to forget, you don't want to leave it there. Leaving it there is kind of a tacit statement that you're okay with it. Presumably, if you're motivated by Hilchos Shabbos, it's not such a concern. So it doesn't seem as much of a downside to do it after Shabbos. Doing it on Shabbos, again, seems like a possibility as well, unless either they're muktzu or you think that this concern that there might be kotzer involved is a consideration, which again is an idea that the earlier postman didn't seem to bring up.
Why would it not be kotzer?
Because if we assume that kotzer is only something that has actually connected, that is actually growing because of its connection.
It's in 3 days, it's not connected.
Right, so then since it hasn't become connected, so we're saying, but what if we're machmir to say that you're in violation of planting before it reaches the 3 days? So should we assume if we call it Zoraya, then we automatically call the opposite kotzer? So we don't find that. That doesn't necessarily appear that that's the case. But maybe there's a different reason to call it kotzer, but again, that's not something that a lot of posts continue to have brought up, so it doesn't seem to be widely accepted as a concern. Hi.
So, like, so we should just, if someone plans to just take it out on Sunday?
Seems like that's the safest plan, and that you could maybe even take it out on Shabbos. Now, once we get to that, the truth is, there's a whole other reason to do it. And we mentioned this a little bit last week also. You could take this as perhaps a raya that it's not core to the definition of Zoraya, but we find the Gemara Maseches Gittin, the Mishnah Maseches Gittin, and Daftan Gimel Amud Beis, where we are told that if somebody, according to the view of Rabbi Yehuda, that if somebody plants on Shabbos, you should uproot it after Shabbos, basically as a knas. It's a penalty that you shouldn't be able to benefit from this plant that you had planted on Shabbos. And the view of Reb Meir was that you only have to do this if it was intentional. B'shogeg, you don't have to. But the view of Rabbi Yehuda, that the Shulchan Aruch follows, I think we had this on the Maamar Kohen, you probably saw this, the view of Rabbi Yehuda is that if it was even b'shogeg, if you planted whether b'mezid or b'shogeg, you have to uproot it after Shabbos so that it shouldn't be around there to benefit from, it shouldn't be a source of hana. So there is a discussion, which is an important discussion from an analytical point of view. It affects how you would make various decisions lahalacha as well. Why is there a distinction between this and bishul? Say, if you cook something, you know, that seems to be the favorite malacha to bound zriya issues off of, you find, besides our whole Rasha Ashman Chesninuch discussion, which is about figuring out the difference between zriya and bishul, there are a number of other cases. You could play a game counting how many different questions there are. Why is Zriya different than Bishul? I seem to be doomed to be brought together all the time. So here also, there is a question that's discussed. That if somebody cooks something on Shabbos, so then he is not allowed to... So if he does it b'shogeg, let's say if he does it b'mezid, so then nobody can eat it on Shabbos. But then after Shabbos, other people can eat it and he can't eat it ever. And if he cooks b'shogeg on Shabbos, so then, again, it shouldn't be eaten on Shabbos. But after Shabbos, both he and others are allowed to eat it. So we don't find the halacha that you have to destroy what you cooked after Shabbos. Should be benefiting from it on Shabbos, but you're allowed to benefit from it after Shabbos. So there is an extensive discussion, many different approaches, as to why that is. Why do we distinguish between Zriya and Bishul for this purpose? If we say that what you plant, you have to uproot, you have to essentially destroy your work, so why do we not go that far when it comes to Bishul? And there are a number of approaches to this question. One approach, the approach that the Bir Halacha writes, is that it has to do with Heker, it has to do with the ability to recognize that Kras is there. that when it comes to baking, so baking is more of an immediate issue, more of something you would do right away, you would use right away. So if I cook my lunch on Shabbos and then, okay, now I can't eat my lunch because of a knas, okay, so then we see that we accomplished something by making it off limits at least till Sunday. But when it comes to planting, planting is more of a long-term activity anyway, so you're not going to be able to really have a recognizable difference just because you didn't use your plant for Shabbos, you waited even a week. You're not going to be able to, no matter how long you wait, it's not really going to be able to have a recognizable effect. So therefore, if you want this knas to take hold, your children, you want the consequences to have an impact, so you're not going to be able to have a comparable impact in the area of Zriya, so therefore we have to be more machmir and we have to completely uproot it. That's one approach. The Tosfos Yontif has a different approach, and he says that it's not really shayach for you to undo the bishul. You can undo planting, but you can't really undo bishul. So what does he mean by that? So some understand that he means that essentially to undo the bishul, you have to destroy the food. There isn't really anything that you can do. But undo your planting, you can simply take the seeds out and then you could plant them again later. You can simply reverse your work, while when it comes to bishul, it's not really shaykh to just undo your work and leave the raw ingredients, literally the raw ingredients, in their original state. Especially if we talk about, let's say, noteya, which we'll get to soon, that noteya, whether it's an av or whether it's something else, noteya is somewhere within the Zriya family, but what it generally means is you take a small tree or something like that and you put it into the ground as opposed to putting seeds. So again, you can take that tree out of the ground and then you can put it back in later. So you can undo your work without destroying the item. So there are those who understand that that's what the Tosfos Yontif is getting at, that it's not really about destroying the item as much. We're not going to say, okay, take your dinner and throw it in the garbage, or any other type of reversal of a malacha that you could think of. You're a boer or something, okay, throw it all back in the mix again. It doesn't really make sense. While when it comes to Zriya, maybe there is such a model. But there are those who want to suggest another difference, which is really related again to the lumdus that's involved in the Sefer Orcha Shabbos. Is a contemporary Sefer on Hilcha Shabbos where he advances an approach along these lines. And he says that the relevant issue that distinguishes Zriya and Bishul is that the Zriya will continue to have an effect. Now, what does that mean? So the Stipler has a similar statement where the Stipler says that since this is going to keep growing, that's essentially what we're concerned about. While the cooked food is certainly not going to get better the longer you leave it lying around. But it could be also that it relates to this Menchas Chinuch Rashash issue. That even if you are the Menchas Chinuch and you feel that as far as the Avera, you violated the Avera the moment you put it in, there's still truth to the Rashash's position, right? There's still truth to the fact that these seeds have not taken root for another 3 days. So in terms of a Hanu Maisav, in terms of your action being successful, so the success has not happened yet. So perhaps we should say that you should interfere with the success of your action. That even if you, again, maintain the Menchas Chinuch's position, that it's not going to save you from the Avera, but certainly from a Knas perspective, from a punitive perspective, we should stop your action from bearing fruit, literally, and we should interfere with that. We should have it uprooted at that point. Which, if that's really the reason, so then the question would be, let's say you're asking this question a week later, and if that's what you're about to ask, let's say the question is, I didn't learn about this halacha until a week and a half after, so should I uproot it? So then maybe you could say, if that's the reason you're coming from, that you have to stop it before it takes root in the 3 day period, let's say, so then maybe after a certain time, that's no longer an effective goal. So as we'll see, there are differences as to what explanation you like. Right, these are not academic differences, but the difference in terms of what reason is there to focus on a knas by Zriya that's more intensive than a knas for Bishul is a relevant question, because we need to know how to apply it within this case, but also how to apply it to other malachos. What are they more comparable to? Are they more comparable to Bishul, or are they more comparable to planting? Yes, sir.
Is there a difference between
Last we mentioned that last week. We mentioned that there were those who say that that's indeed the case. We believe the Dvar Avram made that point, that the fact that it sounds like a knas rather than a clear emergency obligation to prevent you from doing an aver, it does sound a little bit not like the Rashash, unless you want to read into it more. But that's that is taken to be the case, that there are those who made that point. Ifikaya maybe actually made that point. So that's hi.
With the uprooting it,
mm-hmm.
so we could just uproot on Sunday if it's Shabbat, but what if it's a
3-day
Yom Tov?
Mm-hmm.
Shabbat first, so then...
You could theoretically have 3 days pass.
Yeah, or if someone's on would say better to uproot it or better to...
I think he'd probably say better to he, because he personally is a strong Minchas Chinuch fan, if you remember, in this issue. And he also didn't accept even the Eglei Tal's condition that if you have intent to take it out later, it helps. He very much believed that the Aveir was over then. So for him, I think he was pretty much convinced that this is the case. The Aveir is for sure done. So I don't think he personally saw much of an upside to taking it out. So I think he would probably say on Yom Tov not to do it.
Would anybody say to do it other than the Rashash?
Correct. That would be my assumption. So there is yet a fourth explanation, let's say, if we count this way, as to what the difference is. That Mishnah Rishon is the commentary on the Mishnayos. Mishnah Rishon says that the issue is we're trying to fashter what your intent was. Similar to what we just said a second ago, but different just in terms of your intent, in terms of what you want. So when you cook something, presumably you want it for that day. And once we say you can't have it that day, so we have messed you over in the way that we want to mess you over, so to speak, in terms of punitive action. But when it comes to planting, so you plant, you want it there for a long time. You want it to be there long term, so therefore in order to undo that, we have to undo it even at a later date and have that to continue and not just allow a 1 day period after which it elapses. So, as you mentioned, it's instructive to know what the different principles are here, what the different issues are, because there are other questions that could come up in terms of how this penalty should be imposed. So there is a fascinating discussion. If you ever read the writings of Rav Yitzchok Zilberstein, who's a contemporary posek, fascinating way of thinking in general, he has fascinating ideas. There are many different svarim that have been published with his psakim in them. So, for example, this is a sefer on Chumash Vaharevna, where he has some fascinating psakim that he has. And there's a discussion here in this Chumash sefer about a situation that came up. You had an Israeli Baal Tshuva who was a contractor. So, what does he do? He builds houses. And he was a carpenter, a contractor. He had all the skills personally, so he builds houses. So 6 days a week he works and he builds houses for other people. And then he has 1 day off, Saturday, Shabbos, which he wasn't at the time of Shomer Shabbos, so in his spare time he built himself a house. So over the course of many years, it took him 1 day a week of working, over the course of many years he built a house which was built completely on Shabbos, because that was the only day he ever had to work on it. So then he became a Baal Tshuva, so then he learned about this concept of the Knas. So the question became, should he be allowed to continue living in the house? So it's an interesting question. How does this correlate to the various reasons? So this is not about Zriya, it's about Bona. To what extent is there an overlap? To what extent does it correlate to these reasons? So Zilberstein was of the opinion that essentially there is an issue of Knas here, that he should not live in the house under these circumstances. However, it's important to note that the Bir Halacha himself, Mishnah Berurah, writes that when we say that you can't use the item, so you say you can't get hana from it, it's not the same usage of the word hana that we find in halachic literature talking about Nista Daraisa. So for example, we talk about chametz being asur bahana, or the like, so it usually means you can't sell the chametz either. That's also a type of hana. But here, so it sounds like from the Mishnah Berurah that even though you're not supposed to use the item, you can still sell the item. Happens to be that the Chavis Yar, in one of his svarim, writes that that means you can only sell the ingredients. He says, for example, if you cooked something on Shabbos, so you can sell it, at the price of raw meat. You can't sell it at the price of cooked meat in your restaurant. You can't sell it as a cooked steak, because then you're benefiting from your malacha. So you can sell the meat, you can't sell the bishul, so to speak. So here, Rav Zilberstein says he could sell the house based on this bir halacha. So he shouldn't live in the house himself. He says, but he could sell the house. And he wouldn't be machmir to say that you should only sell the price of wood and the like, which would clearly be a much lower level. He said, because that, the Mishnah Berurah himself doesn't make that distinction, and that's more of a chumrah. So he says you don't have to necessarily take that position into account, and he says it's mutter to sell the house. Hi.
In terms of, I know it has to do with gazelle, but like with the Kanat HaShavim,
yes, I think there is some room for that. So it's interesting. So you would think that maybe there is some room to say that here this is going to be such a chumrah on this guy that maybe it's not a kedai knas to make, which you could also say for another reason, because the Mishnah does distinguish between a shogeg and mazid. So how are we characterizing this person before he was a bal tshuva, when he wasn't yet observant? So are we characterizing this as an avera b'mazid? So it sounds like there's room to call that a shogeg. Happens to be in the footnotes in the sefer. So the person who put it together, I don't know who that is, it wasn't Zilberstein himself, somebody else, but he says that it occurred to him that maybe there is a room to be makel on that side and to say that this isn't really characterized as mazid, it's characterized as shogeg, and that he asked Zilberstein that and he didn't accept it. He didn't think that that was an appropriate path to be makel. Okay, it seems like there's what to talk about, and that in terms of the Takanas HaShavim, I think that's also a reasonable consideration. And it's probably a circumstantial question here, that it sounds like the way the question was phrased, that this individual who came and asked the Shailas, that he was very ready to accept whatever the answer was, and if he was told that he couldn't live there, he was told he had to knock it down, he was ready to do whatever he was told. But I think if somebody else had this question, and the rabbi who's being asked this question has a sense that you're really going to create a tremendous setback to this person in terms of everything if you tell him he's got to move out of the house or destroy the house, then I think to factor in some type of Takanas HaShavim approach, I think is a reasonable approach, again, together with some of the other considerations here. And I don't think it would be such an off-base thing to say. But in this particular case, seems that, I guess, he evaluated that the individual was ready to accept whatever he was going to say and not suffer any setback because of it. And he didn't feel that the characterization of shogeg was appropriate usage here, even though the person was not a shomer mitzvah at the time. Okay, so it's a fascinating application. And again, even though in general we're focusing on Zriya issues here, but just since in this case, the Mishnah does say it specifically in the context of Zriya, so it's worth considering these different issues of why there is the Chumrah of uprooting by Zriya more than by Bishul, and all these different reasons impact on figuring out how other Malachos or other situations would fit into the question, how far would we go with a after-the-fact knas. Okay, so that's all in terms of you put seeds into the ground on purpose, so you should take them out. You should also be careful not to throw seeds on the ground without necessarily trying to plant them. We mentioned last week that if you know it's not going to take root because the ground is not arable, the ground is not the kind of ground in which you can plant things, or if you have a situation that's a chicken coop and it happens to be the case we talked about, you're intentionally feeding the chicken, but even if you're not intentionally feeding the chicken, but you know that it's not feasible for anything to last there because the animals are going to eat it up right away, so then that's one thing. But if you have a situation where that's not the expectation, and it rains there, you have wetland, so then it says in the Shulchan Aruch that you're not supposed to do that. The Shulchan Aruch is in Shema Midvav, Sif Dalet, you're not supposed to throw seeds on the ground in a place where you know that it's wet ground and it's going to take root, even if you're doing it just because you are eating and you're finished with the seeds, so you throw them to the ground. That's a real issue of a psik resha. It's a real issue of essentially doing the act of a malacha in a way that it's really going to come up and is going to be a malacha. And therefore, you should maybe even be careful that it's brought down this farm as well. The Tiferes Yisrael writes this in his Kalkelas HaShabbos, that even just eating fruits on the grass is probably not the most advisable activity, because you have seeds that you're getting rid of while you're doing this, and it's very hard not to drop any of them onto the ground, and that's a serious consideration. If the ground is very dry, and it's only going to rain later, so then that's considered to be an Issur D'Rabbanan, which could be we're dealing with Issur D'Rabbanan B'chol here, but again, still problematic, still something to worry about. If you are washing your hands outside over the grass, so then one has to really be careful essentially not to do that, only wash into a basin or wash into a sink if you're washing over the grass. So again, you have the consideration, which the Shulchan Aruch brings again, that that's essentially a psik resha. Essentially, this water is going to fall onto the grass, and it's not shayach that you're not going to water the grass in a way that is helpful. So that's, again, a concern of a psik resha. So that's a serious problem as well. A problem of Zareya. Yeah, that's what it sounds like. And it sounds like essentially a psik resha of Zareya, that even though that's not what you're trying to do, you're trying to wash your hands. But at the end of the day, you're pouring water over your hands into the grass, and that's going to be a direct contribution to their growth. Since it comes out that watering the plants and watering the ground is considered to be an act of Zareya. We saw a little bit from the Lumdus that's in it, that there is a discussion in the Gemara in Moed Katan about whether watering the ground is an issue of Zareya or an issue of Choresh. We'll talk about that a little bit more when we get into the Sugi a little bit. For our intents and purposes, to assume that there's an issue of Zareya here, and that's something that's considered to be a psik resha. Hi.
So the source of this ulcer are eventually going to get something out of it. Would it make a difference if, let's say, you're doing anything, you're walking on someone's property or public property, and you wash your hands, you're not going to get anything of a tree that grows there, you can't even use this thing?
Correct. So that is a relevant consideration. Although, how much it comes into play is a discussion. So the Ramah writes that the truth is, it's even a good idea not to eat outside. That one maybe shouldn't eat on top of grass, because it's hard not to have some type of an issue here with spilling something on the floor, whether it's water for your hands, whether it's water that you're drinking, whatever it is, it's very likely you're going to have a problem. Now, where are we talking about? So there is the possibility, as you're suggesting, that maybe it should only be on your property. The Gemara, as we'll see, the Gemara in Daf Kuf Gimel has a distinction that's made in terms of psik resha, in terms of things that are ultimately going to happen, whether you want them to or not. So we know we haven't gotten to the sugi yet, we'll eventually get into it, but there's a distinction made between a psik resha de nichale and a psik resha de lo nichale. So if it's something that you consider beneficial for yourself, so then that creates an extra problem when it's something that will happen even inadvertently. So the Gemara throws in a distinction that if it's Ara Dechavri, is that what I'm going to say?
It's like a refinement.
Well, so we'll get to that, we get into the psik resha issue, but the Gemara itself raises the issue that Haba Ara Didei Harba Ara Dechavri, this is a Gemara on Daf Kuf Gimel, which will come up much more in the Choresh, so we'll get into it. So the Gemara does make a distinction that when you're doing something in your field, you want your field to grow, so then we're more concerned about Nichale consideration. When it's Ara de Chavre, so it's your friend's land, so apparently you're not happy about him growing. It's not clear why not. It's a whole discussion about the behalf Tlarecha Kamocha. It's not a trivial consideration, but for whatever reason, we're not in the Sugya yet, but the Gemara makes that distinction between your land and somebody else's land. So theoretically, that makes a difference here also, especially once we talk at a remove already. So you're not directly planting, so now you're inadvertently spilling water on the ground. So then we'll have the Ramaz Chumra that you're not even necessarily spilling water on the ground, but you are eating on the ground, and maybe you're likely to spill water on the ground. So once we're already getting a couple of steps removed, so then you could say that really this Chumra only makes sense when it's your own land, and you have what the Gemara says about Ara Didei as opposed to Ara Dechavre. Although the Mishnah Berurah does say he thinks chachila, it's kedai to worry about this even on somebody else's land. So that's a whole discussion, what exactly this applies to, what it doesn't apply to. But once we're getting several layers away, that already it's a chumrah to begin with, and it it's not intentional, you're not even necessarily doing it, and it's somebody else's land. So we are throwing in a number of factors to greatly minimize what's going on. Hi.
I guess it kind of relates to the Todd's idea mm-hmm. we're talking about, so on Sukkot, we have to eat outside.
Oh. Right, so then, very good point. Again, you have the perfect segue questions. So, sorry?
I was thinking the same thing.
Right, so yeah, the perfect segue questions. So that's we just to mention, so the idea of sukkah, so when it comes to sukkah, so essentially you have to eat outside. So there, it's generally accepted in the contemporary Svarim that you should eat in a sukkah and sukkahs, including on Shabbos and Yom Tov, and that we don't take into account this chumrah of the Ramah for that purpose, that be mevatel the mitzvah of sukkah when you have a clear obligation, if you can set up your sukkah in such a way that you don't have this risk, and you could also theoretically put something underneath the sukkah. If you had a tarp or something, or some type of a floor covering that you put underneath the sukkah, you can stop the anything that falls off. You essentially don't have to eat on the grass. So there's no requirement of sukkah. The sukkah has to be on the grass. It might be a requirement because that's the way your house is. You only have a grass area in which to put the sukkah. But in theory, you could address that if you were to put something underneath, which helps. But in any event, it seems to be, it's pretty clear from the contemporary poskim that this is a chumrah, this idea that you shouldn't eat outside on Shabbos. And we would not extend that in a place where it means coming into conflict with the mitzvah of sukkah, even though if you can do what to minimize that possibility, it's still recommended. So it's certainly a concern that also comes up. Yes, sir?
What about in cases like, if you're going to eat outside of like a patio area,
mm-hmm.
and in some patios might be a bit overgrown with grass coming.
Right, so if you're eating directly on hard ground, and again, you know, there. This is a chumrah to begin with. So it's washing on top of the ground is a problem directly. Pouring anything on purpose onto the ground is a problem. Throwing seeds into the ground, that's all more direct problems. But eating on top when you're not doing any of those things, so that's the Ramah's tov, and it's good not to do this. But once what you have directly beneath you is not grass, so we're more concerned about things bouncing, basically, or water trickling off of the concrete or the patio, whatever it is, the wood, whatever it is underneath, then you're adding a whole other level of indirectness and a whole other level of whether that's called kocha or not, whether that's, it's, you have so many different levels that already it's very hard to be machmir on such a setting if you're not directly on top of something that grows. In terms of this type of inadvertent watering, so I think I put this on the Mar Makomos last week. So there is also a discussion, what about Mei Reglayim? If somebody relieves himself on the ground, is that an issue of watering the ground? So there, it's mostly considered, the way it's brought in Shulchan Aruch, is that that's mutter. Because the assumption is that this is not helpful. This is something that damages the growth. This is not something that contributes at all to Zareya. And that's the way it's generally brought, even though there is some discussion about whether or not the assumption is true. Among the Rishonim, the Sefer Yireyim was machmir about this. The Sefer Yireyim thought that there was some room to be concerned. And the Tiferes Yisrael, in his commentary, so he writes that he was told by his scientific experts that it is productive, that it is helpful to the plants, and therefore, since he has the Urayim who was Machmir, and he was told that it's helpful, so he finds it hard to be Makel on this. Again, Shulchan Aruch was Makel, and many others afterward were Makel. Pashtus, because again, it's a machlokas whether or not it's helpful. And here, this is also, as some poskim point out, it's clearly not the derech of Zariah. The intent is clearly not for the purposes of Zariah. And we're also throwing in another factor that once we assume that this is very indirect and many different levels, it's presumably not an issue of an issur daraisa. So then there is a kavod abrius consideration. Presumably what we're talking about here is that this is the person's only option, otherwise he has to really endanger himself and compromise his dignity to a great extent. So we know that for this purpose, it also comes up on other places in Hilchos Riyah that you may have seen in the Mar Makomos, that in general, kavra brios is a reason to be lenient when we can, and that's really one of the factors that's playing a role here. This is not something a person is doing for any other reason other than it's an emergent physical need, which is essentially a kavra brios consideration, which is what allows also for a lenient attitude towards this. In terms of spinning on the ground, also the Shvisas HaShabbos writes that he thought that that was a consideration, that's something you shouldn't do. While some later svarim, such as Rav Nissim Karelitz and his Chot HaShani, he understands that this is not something to worry about because, first of all, again, you don't have intent to grow the grass, and the effect is so minimal, if anything, that we're talking about something that's not going to really allow much moisture to actually reach to the grass. So he didn't think that that was something that we necessarily have to be concerned about. Hi.
I don't understand how you can say that it's such a minimal amount if we ended up saying that Zerei might be a culture.
Because the effect, well, Zerei, when we say Zerei a culture, we mean these seeds. Right? Once we talk about the more indirect type of impact, even though the Rambam is interesting to track, we'll talk about this a little bit, we'll talk about the Av and the Toldos of Zerei. So sometimes the Rambam says, so yes, so this is Zerei and Chiyuv B'Kulshu, and sometimes he doesn't. So essentially, we know it applies to the seeds going in. The question is, when we talk about other things which are in the Zerea family, so do we say that any type of minimal impact is significant? So especially with the perspective that we had before, right, that we said the reason to say a kol shu is because the impact of a small seed is great, but once we're looking now at the impact, we're saying you're watering the grass, and therefore that helps the grass. Well, does it, or does it help it in a completely unrecognizable, minimal way? So that's really where there is room to perhaps distinguish. This also comes up, the question was raised about sukkah. So another issue that comes up in terms of sukkahs is sometimes, let's say it's raining outside, you're not going to eat in the sukkah because it's raining, and you'll put a cover on top of the sukkah. Maybe your sukkah has one built in that you can put up. Maybe you just put something on top, whatever it is. You have something on top of the sukkah. And a lot of rain has gathered on top of this sukkah covering. So now you want to take it off because now it stopped raining. So now you want to eat in the sukkah. So you want to take the covering off. You can't eat there with the covering on. It's a schach issue. So you want to take the covering off. What do you do about the fact that it's going to splash water now onto the grass? So that's it's a problem. If it's going to splash water onto the grass, so strictly speaking, that seems to be a significant issue. But there are two considerations to keep in mind. One is that the poskim write that, similar to your patio issue from before, that if it's not going to go directly onto the grass, but let's say you could spill it onto ground, and then it's going to trickle off from the ground, either onto concrete or something like that, but it's going to trickle off, so the trickle off is already, again, indirect. No intention to water the plants, and it's happening indirectly, so again, there's room to be makel for that purpose. And also, there is another significant consideration that a lot of poskim thought was relevant, and this affects a lot of other issues that come up, that if we're talking about, let's say, immediately after a rain, so if the situation is that the grass is already drenched because of the rain, so now you're pouring water from the top of your sukkah onto drenched grass, which is not going to add anything, so then there were a number of poskim who thought, probably a significant camp of poskim who thought that that's not a issue of watering the grass. We're talking about watering the grass. We're talking about that there's some benefit to the grass because you're adding water. But if the grass is already drenched, it's already soaked because it just rained, so now you're just saturating it further. And it's possibly even harmful. We mentioned that a little bit last week, that to overwatering it's not really helpful either. So to add water to drenched grass, so a very strong group of poskim felt that this was not something you necessarily had to feel was problematic. Rav Tzvi Pesach Frank had a slightly different formulation on this. That he added that even if it's not necessarily harmful, let's say, but maybe you'll say that it'll be helpful because even though right now it doesn't need watering because it's wet, but by adding water there, so eventually it'll draw on this water a few days from now. A few days from now it'll use up the water that it already had, but it'll now benefit from the extra water that you spilled on top of it. That's already not on Shabbos. Already you're adding to its growth on Tuesday, whenever it's going to get up to this water, so that's already not something to worry about. So that's a strong basis that, of heter that helps out significantly in these situations, that if you're dealing with a post-rainstorm, so if you're taking off the covering while it's still soaked outside, so then you're not necessarily adding. So that might mean you should chop a run, that if it rained Friday night, let's say, and it stopped raining Shabbos morning, and you're going to have lunch several hours from now, you might want to take it off now so that you'll take advantage of the ground still being wet, so that you have that tzad l'hakel as well, instead of, let's say, waiting a little bit and it dries off, and then it's a more complicated question. So that's, but that when the ground is wet, so assuming that whatever made the top of your sukkah wet also made the ground wet, so then that is a significant makom l'hakel that helps out. So one of the major discussions that comes up in this whole question of Zareya, it's a fascinating discussion, which you might be surprised by how lenient some of the earlier sources are. So what if you have a sprinkler system, let's say you have a faucet system, where you want to turn it on Erev Shabbos and leave it on so that you are essentially watering your plants throughout Shabbos. So here we're talking about, on the one hand, something that is absolutely a problem in terms of watering your plants, and you're doing it for the purpose of your plants, to grow your plants. The issue that helps is that you're doing it from before Shabbos. You're turning it on Shabbos and leaving it on Shabbos. So what might surprise you to learn is that that's something that the Shulchan Aruch explicitly allows, based on a Gemara earlier on Shabbos and Daf Yud Ches, that you can turn on water from before Shabbos and leave it on Shabbos in order to saturate, in order to water your crops. So that being the case, there still are some nuances to talk about. So first of all, why is this different? As the Ramah discusses, that if you look in some of Reishman Beis, this is where this is all brought up, is Reishman Beis, hey, there, this is in a different section of the Shulchan Aruch, it's talking about things that you can or can't do on Friday going into Shabbos. So it says over there that you're allowed to do this, you're allowed to set the water on beforehand. And there, the question is, so why is it that it's the Ramah's Machmir, for example, we'll talk about this when we get into Tochein, that if you have some type of a mill, some type of a water mill, let's say that's operating based on the river going through it, or it's operating based on the wind, a windmill, and you're going to put something in there to be ground up before Shabbos, so the Ramah prohibits that. There's a whole discussion on what level to prohibit that. But there is a concern of avsha milsa, that's going to be a very publicly known thing, and it makes noise and people see it, and therefore it looks bad, which sounds like it's a drabbanan consideration, but a consideration nonetheless, which you might think should apply here. So that Tzitz Eliezer has a tshuva about this, where he says it's not the case, it's not comparable, because there that makes a lot of noise, and this doesn't make a lot of noise. And therefore, there's room to be makel. He says, in general, the concern of avsha milsa, the concern of something being very public, that's a concern, he says, for the nishmoyin and not for the nirin, for things that are heard, and not just for things that are visible. Hi. I think I know what you're going to ask, but sorry. So laundry also, you have, well, laundry also have a noisy consideration also.
They're not supposed to hang it.
Oh, so you're saying that it's nearing. I thought you were the learning machine. Right, so then I have to figure out exactly what he means by that distinction. We'll see that it's not so. So that distinction is made by Tzitz Eliezer and a few others. Yeah.
Is there any one that you can say there's a distinction? Because unlike the case of the Gemara, it's starting before Shabbos going into, but here with, let's say, a sprinkler system, it might just start on Shabbos?
So if it starts on Shabbos, so far we haven't discussed it starting on Shabbos. We're talking so far, you're going to ask maybe about timers, which we'll get to in a minute, but so far we haven't discussed it yet. We're talking about you turned it on before Shabbos. So turning it on before Shabbos, so far we see that seems to be agreed upon lehater. There was a chumrah of the Chazon Ish, which was not about this part of the equation. The Chazon Ish also agreed that it was mutter to do this. Again, it's based on the Gemara, it's based on the Shulchan Aruch. It's a pretty undisputed hater. The Chazon Ish had a chumrah that applies to another half of the equation, that it's agreed you can have it on, and it's also agreed you can turn it off. We discussed that a little bit last week, that turning it off essentially is not a malach at all. So just stopping the water from coming is not a malacha, and that even if your concern is that if you leave the water on, you're going to flood or drown your plants. So we mentioned last week, and this is Karelitz's point, that that's not in the category of what the Yerushalmi says, that things that benefit the growth by keeping away problems is also Zoraya. He said, this is different. That means you're taking out the worms that are inside the plants. But just stopping some external force from coming in, that's not considered to be a malacha of Zoraya. So it seems to be agreed that you can not only have it on before, but you can also turn it off. However, the Chazanish had a different chumr. The Chazanish said, it assumes that the way it works is that you have one key faucet where the main thrust comes from, and then it splits out into a lot of other faucets which have their own ability to stop. You could turn off some of them. They have one thing controlling everything. And then each one you could turn it on, turn it off, like the Kiddush cups, you know, that pour out into, so you have, you could turn off any one of them you want, or you could have it go into 5 cups or 8 cups or 2 cups, depending on how many you turn on and turn off. So the Chazanish said that when you're turning this off on Shabbos, you should only turn it off at the central main source, because otherwise, if it's being split out among many sub pipes, so then when you turn it off at one of them and the main thrust is still coming, you're going to increase the force of the other. It's going to, the same force is now going to be divided among fewer faucets, so it's going to come out, you're essentially increasing the force on the other ones. So he says the effect of turning off one will be increase the others. He says that's a problem. And he also says the problem if your household system is connected to this system and you have those same pipes giving water inside your house is giving water to this system, and you're affecting one through the other, that's also theoretically a problem, he writes. So Rav Tzvi Pesach Frank thought there were a number of reasons why this isn't a problem, why you don't have to worry about this chumrah. And others thought that it was a concern. Gedalia Felder of Toronto, in his Yisodi Yeshur, and he upgeschlugs all of the defenses. Rav Tzvi Pesach Frank has 4 different reasons why he thinks this is very indirect, and it's a kochkocho, and it's all kinds of reasons why he doesn't think that this is really a concern, and Rav Leif Felder thinks it is a concern. He has different reasons. Doesn't necessarily correlate so much to the metzias of what we may use nowadays, but to the extent that it does, I thought that the Chazanish's concern about turning it off was a concern. So what does come up, the question about our current day metzias, is so what about our modern day sprinkler systems, which are much more visible than I think what's being described here. That it's very hard to believe that the sprinkler systems that we have and going up in the air and everyone sees them, is that really in the same category as what is probably being described here, which is much more subtle, where you, maybe you have in your backyard something that's just dumping water out into the plants, but it's not something that everyone who goes past sees a lot of activity. So it's just very hard to believe that there isn't a difference. And indeed, there are many very wonderful svarim written by Rabbi Yisrael David Harfenis. You can ask Rabbi Simon, he's very friendly with him. Rabbi Yisrael David Harfenis is a Talmud Chacham in the Satmar community and is the author of many, many Sifrei Halacha. And by the time I finish the sentence, he'll probably be author of many more. He comes out with many svarim. Once upon a time, he was primarily known for his Sefer on Zmanim. The Sefer called Yisrael V'Hazmanim, which is very helpful for all issues of calculating time. So he has a couple of volumes on that. And I think that was known as his main Sefer, because I think his base medrash is called Yisrael V'Hazmanim. But in recent years, he has many, many other svarim since then, other titles. So he has a series called Mekadesh Yisrael, which is about the Yom Tovim. And every Yontif, he comes out with a volume about just that Yontif. It's a volume on Shavuos. You can't find so many volumes that are just about Hilchos Shavuos, don't have so many complicated halachas. Remember by Simon commenting, it was known as Achilas Cheesecake Hilchoso, because you don't think there are that many different halachas that are relevant to Shavuos. So he has a lot to say on a lot of important topics. So in addition, he also has a series that's just about Shabbos. So he keeps coming out with more volumes about that. It's called Nishmas Shabbos. It's very confusing if you try to buy it because it keeps making new volumes about material that he's already written about and with different numbering systems, so you can't figure out anything. But if you can find what you're looking for, so he has a lot of important practical tshuvas about Shabbos issues. So in his discussions about Hilchos Riyah, he basically has came out a volume on every malacha, or a volume on every few malachas of practical tshuvas. So he discusses this question about the modern day sprinklers. And he says, like we're saying here, that it's hard to believe that that is okay compared to what was talked about in the earlier Sfarim, that the type of releasing of water into the plants is probably something much more subtle and much less obvious. And to have sprinklers, the whoop-whoop sprinklers that are going up and down and everyone who goes past can see them, it's hard to believe that that's not comparable to the windmill. And he says also, he happens to think that the distinction that was made between, and this addresses your point, the distinction that was made between that which is seen and that which is heard, he doesn't think it's a real distinction. He doesn't buy that distinction. Since Eliezer makes that distinction, he doesn't think it's a credible distinction. He says, Lemaise, it's about public. If something is very public because it's very visible and everyone who walks past your house can see it, that's he thinks that should be just as much of a problem as something that is very audible. Happens to also be these are audible also. You can hear the, you know, I guess the question of how, what decibel level makes something audible, but these are noisy and visible, so it's hard to believe that we don't have an avshe milsa issue once we're talking about something that's in that category.
Okay, we have a... Right. So is it possible he's referring to the dripping?
Oh, I think he is. I think he sure is. Right, and it's not just him, but it's all the posts come up leading up to him talk about the Chazon Ish also, who are talking about this, but I think they're all talking about those types of...
Those would be
okay. The only chumrah that was brought up in that context was just the question of how you turn it off. You have to worry about turning it off. But everyone agrees from the Mishnah of the Shulchan Aruch to contemporary 20th century poskim that there's some scenario where it's mutter to have water going on. What we're discussing now, though, is what if it's not a subtle backyard type of thing, but this is a very obvious whoop-whooping sprinkler that makes a lot of noise and is very visible. So then maybe that is something we have to be more machmir about, and indeed this is the position that Rav Harfner took. I think Daniel was on the list.
Actually, I have a question. It would be different. A lot of sprinklers are prone to only go on at night.
Mm-hmm.
So they would see that, not, maybe that's not why, just because there's no sun, so it's better for the plants if the water doesn't evaporate. Also, what if it's set before Shabbos to go on Shabbos?
Okay, so that's two separate
also,
questions.
Also, there's non-Jews, what is the program? Because a lot of times there are partners that are responsible for the sprinklers.
Right, so that's three separate questions. So let's try to talk about those in order. We're going to get to them anyway. In terms of nighttime, so once we talk about public, so nighttime should make a difference. It happens to be, it's also so quoted from Shlomo Zalman Orbach, who also thought that the modern-day big-deal kind of sprinklers are more problematic, and that it's a Marasayan issue. And he says, so therefore, he thought, once you have a Marasayan issue, he thinks even at night, it's not right to do. It's a question how far you take that, because basically the idea is, you know, Chazal has a statement in the Gemara that kol man da'asru chachamim mishum Marasayan afilu b'chadri chadarim asur. That once we say something is asur, mishum Marasayan, so then even in private, it's prohibited. But what I think that means, you know, some people, you know, sometimes you learn in elementary school that, oh, Marasayan means it shouldn't look like you're doing an Avera, so you shouldn't go into, they usually give the kids an example, you shouldn't go into non-kosher restaurants because it looks like you're eating non-kosher food. But that's not something that the Mishnah specifically prohibited. That's just the best example the teacher can think of. So then the question comes up, so now you're on a highway somewhere in the middle of Montana and you need to use a bathroom, and the only bathroom is in a non-kosher Mosa. So you can assume that nobody necessarily assumes that you're eating non-kosher food or that the McDonald's is kosher just because you're using the bathroom. People know you use bathrooms in these settings. So the question becomes, do you say, oh, afilu b'chadri chadarim, it's asr? So I don't think it's every time. It's when Chazal made an isr, and that isr is motivated by Marasayan, so then that becomes an objective isr. So even in private, it's prohibited. But when it's not so much that there's an objective isr, but that we're worried something looks bad, so then it depends. Does it look bad? Do people see? If it's very public and people see, then we're worried it looks bad. If it's not so public and people don't see, then it doesn't look so bad. So there's a more subjective factor here. So where do you categorize this? Do you see this as plugging into an existing concern, midrabanan, that therefore we should now standardize even at nighttime? Or do you see it more just really basically a subjective issue of how public this is, and therefore if it's in your backyard in the middle of the night, something like that, already there's more room to be makel. So there's some subjectivity in terms of how to address that issue. Mar science is always drabanas. Well, Mar science are always drabanas for the most part.
But the idea that it's an issue in Chalei Chadar is only by the rice. I think there's some Rishon
to
say that.
But it's hard to fit into the sense, because for the most part, the Isurim of Mar science are generally drabanas. The concept of not being suspicious. The Visim Nikiyim is a deraisa, but the specifics of...
I'm saying what you're going to be more assigned on, like in this case.
We're talking about what Yisra it's relevant to. Right, so here it is a deraisa, it's a relevant to Yisra of Zareya. So there's some subjectivity involved in what would be private enough to make it okay. And so Shlomo Zalman happens to say, in the middle of the night, he thinks it's a problem. I could hear somebody disagreeing with that. So what about doing it on a timer? So doing it on a timer... So that should seem to be no different. That if we say it's mutter to leave it on from before Shabbos, so it would seem to be that the timer should be no worse. That's what logic sounds like, because what's worse than having it, once you have it on, it's already suspicious, and we're allowing it or not allowing it, depending on the circumstance, so the timer shouldn't be any worse. This, Rav Harfenis has another tshuva about where he thinks the timer is worse. He thinks there is a Marasayan consideration there, because he thinks people will see you all day. They see, okay, in the morning the sprinkler wasn't on, now they say the sprinkler all of a sudden goes on. So it does create a Marasayan that you're turning it on right now, that there is something to worry about. And again, there's a subjective factor there also, because the more people know that this is the way people do things, then they're not going to suspect that. And, if you invented a timer and no one else ever had one before, or it's not widespread that there is such a thing, that is a concern. Nowadays, I think probably people are aware of timers. So strictly speaking, Maker Adin, it's probably no different than leaving it on beforehand. Again, the question is, what type of situation are we comfortable leaving it on beforehand? Are we comfortable with the very public sprinkler type systems, or should we say, and I think there is a large svar to say this, that we're only comfortable with the more subtle type of backyard kind of thing, and not these very public displays, which are more in an Avshin Milsa type of category. It could also be, I was discussing this with Berger, he mentioned also that some of the tshuvas they're talking about, not talking about your front lawn, they're talking about your crops, which are going to go bad. They're talking about much more of a tzorech to be makel to begin with, even though you don't find that the earlier literature is only begrudgingly allowing it. The cases where it's mutter, the earlier literature is allowing it legamri, but the fact that there's more of a tzorech involved in those farmland settings than there are in your front lawn, maybe that should be somewhat factored into the equation. And, it's probably a reasonable position to be brought into the discussion as well. So all of that has a lot of very practical implications. So the truth is, maybe we'll just a quickly review. We spoke about it, then we'll wrap it up because we're just about out of time. So we didn't talk about all the Hilchos Zriya. There's still a lot more. So we'll probably, since we have more Lumdish Zriya to talk about this week, so we'll probably have a Zriya day next Sunday as well. I'll have to talk to you about the Metzius next Sunday. But one of the major practical issues, which I Davka left for the end because I want to get to the Sugya first anyway, is we'll talk this week about the Rambam statement about soaking seeds in water, which I think you may have seen already from Rambam Makomos, and that has a lot of practical implications also. Hydroponics, the idea of growing things in water as opposed to land, there's a lot to talk about that, so that's a practical issue we didn't touch upon today. The source material for that sugya will hopefully have more to say about it over the course of the week, and then eventually we'll get into it more. So what did we talk about in terms of some practical halachic issues? So we talked about our whole lumdish discussion of Rosh Hashanah and Chasinuch. Practically speaking, what do you do? We mentioned the approach that the halacha is probably, if we had to vote, the halacha is probably like the Menuchas Chinuch, but maybe it's worth worrying about the Rosh Hashanah and taking the seeds out anyway. And then Shabbos considerations of doing it on Shabbos itself is if it's muktzah or not, or whether we should say there's a svar to say that there is kasira here, even though we're not assuming that there's a direct parallel that every act of zriya is an act of kasira. And then we mentioned that there is a din anyway, is a knas d'rabbanan, that even inadvertent violation of zriya should be undone afterwards. And that's in contrast with bishul. While bishul, a person who cooks on purpose, is not allowed to use it ever, but others are allowed to use it after Shabbos. And if he does it b'shogeg, he's also allowed to use it after Shabbos. So we're significantly more machmir by zriya than by bishul. And we talked about a number of different approaches as to why that is. Knowing which is the correct answer is important, because it addresses how we would apply other malachos or other situations even within zriya. So we mentioned the Bir Halacha, that it's not a recognizable knas to just wait a day. We mentioned the Tosfos Yontif, that it's not shayach to just undo the bishul the same way as it is shayach to undo the zriya. That could be understood as you'd have to destroy the food itself as opposed to just destroying the work. Or it could be understood as really relating to this whole machlokas, that here, even if you agree with the Menuchas Chinuch that the Isser is violated immediately, but still your goal has not been accomplished until the seeds take root, and therefore maybe you're supposed to stop for the knas meeting, is you should stop your goal from being accomplished, which isn't relevant to cooking because the cooking is already done, it's over, while the seeds continue to take root or continue to grow even beyond that, which is a point that the stipler made. And we mentioned also the Mishnah Rishonah that says it's about frustrating what you wanted to do. So you wanted to do this for that day as opposed to the Zriya, which you wanted to do for other days. I don't remember if we mentioned earlier, by the way, I should mention, it's relevant to the question, which we'll also answer now about the guy who built the building, that, so in the Mishnah, it says that Rabbi Yehuda says even b'shogeg, and Rabbi Meir says not b'shogeg. So Shulchan Aruch paskins like Rabbi Yehuda that even b'shogeg were machmer. But the Vilna Gaon paskins like Rabbi Meir, they're only machmer on a mezid. So there are those who maintain that if it's a big hefzid, if it's really going to cost you a lot, that there's room to be makel like the Reb Meir, that only to be machmir if it was b'mezid. So we talked about this question of somebody who built a house purely on Shabbos, so should he be allowed to use it afterwards? We mentioned that Reb Zilberstein was machmir based on some of these explanations rather than others, but that it doesn't mean you can't get a hana in the classic halachic sense. It means you can sell it, because the Mishnah Berurah says you can sell the ingredients, you can sell what you made, you just can't use it yourself. And even though the Chavos Yair says it only means the ingredients, because you can't be nene from the work, here there's a big difference. He says since that's not explicit, the Mishnah Berurah is willing to be makel without that qualification. But we mentioned, as the question was raised, maybe there's a good tzad to be makel, A, because of a tekanas hashavin consideration, and also because of maybe you could call this guy a shogeg if he wasn't observant at the time. I thought they were both reasonable considerations. It has to be that one of the two was discussed in this psak, the shogeg issue, and Reb Zilberstein didn't buy it for some reason, but again, in a different circumstance, I wouldn't be surprised if somebody was makel. That we mentioned also not throwing seeds onto the ground, even if it's not for the purposes of planting, let's say just because you're finished eating. That's really a concern of a psik resha, and if the ground is dry, it's an issur d'rabbanan, but still a problem. Washing hands is also a problem on the grass because of the psik resha, the water is going to contribute to the grass. And we mentioned the Ramaz Chumra, not to eat outside because of the concern that things are going to happen. We talked about whether or not there is a distinction between your land and somebody else's land, because the Gemara does raise that distinction. So once we're several levels of Chumra, it's worth bringing that in as well. And we also mentioned that if it's going to interfere with the mitzvah of sukkah, it's pretty much agreed that this is not something that should interfere with the mitzvah of sukkah. It's a chumrah to begin with, but there are ways to mitigate what extent your mitzvah of sukkah would impact on this. We talked about Meir Aglayim. Shulchan Aruch says mutter, pashtus because it's not helpful to the crops. There was the Tiferes Yisrael based on the Iranian that thought there was room to be machmir. Consensus seems to be makel also because of the kavod abrios and not the kedarach consideration that is involved here. When it comes to spitting, the Shvitzah Shabbos who says that's a concern. Rav Nissen Karelis thought it's not a concern. It's neither intentional nor any type of significant impact, and not something to really bring into the equation. And then we talked also about the question of taking the covering off of the sukkah, that if it's rained and your covering is it's wet and you're going to pour water on the floor. So that is, in theory, a consideration, but it's mitigated by two factors. One is if you have flat ground underneath, like concrete underneath, it's going to be indirect trickling. That's already makom l'hakel. And perhaps the more likely makom l'hakel, that if you have drenched ground, saw that many posts can found that drenched ground is not helpful and is mutter, maybe even harmful. And you see Pesach Frank point that even if ultimately it will eventually be utilized, and we utilize after Shabbos already, and that's already not a malacha on Shabbos. And we talked about the important question of leaving a sprinkler on from before Shabbos on Shabbos. We saw how all the earlier sources essentially say that that is mutter. The Chazanish is concerned about turning it off in a way that allows the pressure to be increased somewhere else. And we talked about whether or not that is a concern. And then we talked about whether or not this really applies to our modern-day sprinkler systems, which are very visible in the public. Is that really comparable to what was talked about in all the earlier sources? We mentioned the strong possibility that it's not comparable and should be more stringently addressed. And then the question also of whether a timer makes a difference. And the Iker HaDin, it seems like a timer should not make much of a difference, because if it's mutter to have it on, then having it turned on in the middle doesn't look like it's really much of a difference. We mentioned that Rav Parfenis did think there was a Maris Ayin consideration, that it would look like it suddenly got turned on by your hands on Shabbos. I didn't address your question about having a non-Jew do it. Presumably, this is an important so, just to quickly mention, that we'll get into this in more detail. But we spent a lot of time talking about Malacha as referring specifically to an action you do. And once you have a shliach in the middle, on a deraisa level, it's radically changed. However, there is a strong possibility, and we'll find the right time to get into this at more length, that when we're talking about Mr. Darabanan, very often there's no difference. It's just as bad having a non-Jew do it for you and having you do it. So since here we're concerned about Marasayim, we're essentially concerned about a rabbinical component, it doesn't really matter who it is who turned it on. It's on your property. It's going to look like it was you. It doesn't matter that it was actually activated by your non-Jewish gardener. So the Iker HaDin, there's room to be makel. However, there were many who thought there was a Marasayim consideration and something to be worried about in terms of this. Okay, so we'll stop here. Tomorrow's a normal Monday, so we'll continue the Lumdus of Zriya tomorrow and hopefully wrap it up.